This is Audible.
Worse than war, genocide, eliminationism, and the ongoing assault on humanity. By Daniel Jonah Goldhagen. Narrated by Patrick Lawler. Copyright 2009 by Daniel Jonah Goldhagen. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Public Affairs and was produced in the year 2009 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Preface. The Choice. Hundreds of millions of people are at risk of becoming the victims of genocide and related violence. They live in countries governed by political regimes that have been and are inherently prone to committing mass murder. In some countries, such as Sudan, the killing is ongoing. In others, such as Rwanda, the killing has been recent. In still others, such as Kenya, the threat of mass murder has appeared real, if not imminent. In yet others, although no warning signals suggest immediate danger, mass slaughter could begin precipitously. Our time, dating from the beginning of the 20th century, has been afflicted by one mass murder after another, so frequently and in aggregate of such massive destructiveness that the problem of genocidal killing is worse than war. Until now, the world's peoples and governments have done little to prevent or stop mass murdering. Today, the world is not markedly better prepared to end this great scourge of humanity. The evidence of this failure is overwhelming. It is to be found in Tibet, North Korea, the former Yugoslavia, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Rwanda, southern Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Darfur. Individuals, institutions, and governments in every region of the world, we all have a choice. We can persist in our malign neglect that consists of three parts, failing to face the problem squarely and to understand the real nature of genocide, failing to recognize we can far more effectively protect hundreds of millions of people and radically reduce mass murder's incidence, and failing to choose to act on this knowledge. Or we can focus on this scourge, understand its causes, its nature and complexity, and its scope and systemic quality, and, building upon that understanding, craft institutions and policies that will save countless lives and also lift the lethal threat under which so many people live. How can we not choose the second? Introduction. Clarifying the issues. Chapter 1. Eliminationism, Not Genocide. Harry Truman, the 33rd President of the United States, was a mass murderer. He twice ordered nuclear bombs dropped on Japanese cities. The first, an atomic bomb, exploded over Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and the second, a nuclear bomb, detonated over Nagasaki on August 9th. Truman knew that each would kill tens of thousands of Japanese civilians who had no direct bearing on any military operation and who posed no immediate threat to Americans. In effect, Truman chose to snuff out the lives of approximately 300,000 men, women, and children. Upon learning of the first bomb's annihilation of Hiroshima, Truman was jubilant, announcing that this is the greatest thing in history. He then followed up in Nagasaki with a second greatest thing. It is hard to understand how any right-thinking person could fail to call slaughtering unthreatening Japanese mass murder. People, particularly Americans, have offered many justifications and excuses for Truman's mass slaughter. That it was necessary to end the war. That it was necessary to save tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of American lives. But as Truman at the time knew, and as his advisors, including his military advisors, told him prior to the bombing of Hiroshima, none of these was true. Then Supreme Allied Commander of the Forces in Europe and soon-to-be American President Dwight Eisenhower explained, during his recitation of the relevant facts about the plan for using the atomic bomb, I had been conscious of a feeling of depression, and so I voiced to him, Secretary of War Henry Stimson, my grave misgivings, first on the basis of my belief that Japan was already defeated and that dropping the bomb was completely unnecessary, and secondly because I thought that our country should avoid shocking world opinion by the use of a weapon whose employment was, I thought, no longer mandatory as a measure to save American lives. It was my belief that Japan was, at that very moment, seeking some way to surrender with a minimum loss of face. Truman, in his press release informing the American people about the annihilation of Hiroshima, offered the primitive logic of retribution. The Japanese began the war from the air at Pearl Harbor. They have been repaid manyfold. These justifications notwithstanding, the best that can be said for Truman, for those Americans, in August 1945, 85%, and others who supported his mass slaughters, and for those who have been duped by the drumbeat of self-exculpation into believing that the slaughter was just, in 1995, 72% of Americans age 50 to 64, and 80% of those 65 and older, is that he and they, not otherwise wicked people, perpetrated or supported this twin horror owing to erroneous information or reasoning, to moral blindness, or to hardened hearts after years of war. Even this best face does not change what Truman did. What if Adolf Hitler had dropped a nuclear bomb on a British or American city? What if during the Cuban Missile Crisis, Nikita Khrushchev had incinerated Miami? Would we not call such acts mass murder, even though in Hitler's case it would have also been done with the veneer of a rationale that it was a military operation and not the mass slaughter of non-combatants? In the case of Hitler, we would inscribe his act prominently in his long ledger of evil. Why should Truman's wholesale extermination of so many men, women, and children be different? What if the Japanese had not surrendered a few days after Nagasaki's bombing, and Truman had proceeded to annihilate another Japanese city, and then another, and another, and another? At what point would people stop making excuses? At what point would all people speak plainly about his mass murdering? Why would the successive nuclear annihilation of the people of, say, 5 or 10 Japanese cities be deemed mass murder, which undoubtedly it would be, but the slaughter of the Japanese of only 2 cities not be? Or what if the Americans had conquered a few Japanese cities, stopped their advance, and proceeded to shoot 140,000 Japanese civilians, men, women, and children, the number who died immediately or from injuries in the next few months from the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, explaining to Japan's leaders and its public that only the surrender would prevent more mass slaughters? Would Truman's apologists have similarly justified this more conventional mass murdering as militarily and morally necessary? What if 3 days later Truman ordered American soldiers to shoot another 70,000 Japanese men, women, and children from a second city? Would we not call such slaughters mass murder? Except for the technological difference between 210,000 bullets and 2 nuclear bombs, the nuclear bombs destroyed also the cities themselves and subsequently caused at least another 60,000 deaths owing to radiation poisoning and other injuries, it is hard to see how, in deciding whether each constitutes mass murder, these two scenarios differ in any conceptually or factually meaningful way. Truman's chief of staff, William Leahy, a Navy admiral, abhorred using nuclear weapons against the Japanese, and not only because the Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender. Leahy explains, "My own feeling was that in being the first to use it, we had adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. I was not taught to make wars in that fashion, and wars cannot be won by destroying women and children, because that is not war, but mass murder." I start with Truman's mass annihilation of Japanese to indicate how deficient our understanding of large-scale mass murder is. The willful slaughter of more than 250,000 people in full view of the world should be universally recognized for what it was, causing the label mass murderer to be affixed to Truman's name. Japanese, to a degree, people in other countries, and especially critics of the United States, do see Truman's use of nuclear weapons this way. But in the United States and the corridors of power, it is denied or ignored. That Truman's nuclear incineration of Hiroshima and Nagasaki's people is not invariably and prominently listed among our time's mass murders points us to one of the acute problems, aside from truthfulness, confounding our understanding. The problem of definition. How should we define mass murder so that we do not misconstrue it? Why have Truman's actions not been universally seen and condemned for what they were? For Americans, the problem of facing up to the crimes of one's own country and countrymen is real. Most peoples have prettified self-images that cover up blemishes, airbrush scars and open sores on the self-drawn portraits of their nations, their pasts, and themselves. For Americans, Turks, Japanese, Poles, Russians, Chinese, French, British, Guatemalans, Croats, Serbs, Hutu, and countless others, the ugliness that they easily see in others, they fail to acknowledge in themselves, their own countries, or their countrymen. How can we establish appropriate general criteria that give people a more accurate view of themselves? Americans and others fail to see and speak truthfully about these American crimes against the Japanese for other reasons. The difficulty of adequately defining mass murder or genocide is compounded by the common failure to keep it distinct from two other essential tasks, explanation and moral evaluation. For many people, especially Americans, it just feels wrong and offensive to speak of Truman in the same breath as Hitler, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, and Pol Pot. Why? The latter four killers were certifiable monsters. They destroyed millions because they deemed certain people human trash or obstacles to their power or millennial or imperial goals. Truman, however, was no such monster. While these monsters' mass murdering was an organic expression of their long-standing racist or ideological views and political aspirations, Truman's was accidental, owing to a confluence of circumstances that he would have preferred never came about. While these monsters planned, even lusted, to kill millions and created institutions explicitly for such purposes, Truman would have gladly had history take another course. While each of these monsters killed as an integral part of his use of power, did so over much of the time that he held power and would have continued doing so on had he stayed in power, Truman killed in a very specific setting, in the context of a brutal and extremely destructive war that Japan had launched against the United States, starting with a surprise attack on the American Pacific Fleet in Pearl Harbor. After destroying much of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Truman stopped. When one looks at each of the other four, it is hard not to conclude that, if the term is to be applied to human beings, each was a monster. When one looks at Truman, one sees an otherwise conventional man who committed monstrous deeds. Still, none of these distinctions speaks to the definition of mass murder. None suggests that the nature of Truman's acts and those of the other four are different. Each distinction, rather, addresses either differences between why the four monsters and Truman acted, or how we ought to evaluate the four and Truman morally. None makes Truman's willful killing of Japanese children in Hiroshima and Nagasaki any less a mass murderous act than Hitler's, Stalin's, Mao's, or Pol Pot's willful killing of Jewish, Ukrainian, Chinese, or Cambodian children. This failure to distinguish between defining an act, explaining it, and morally judging it likely leads many to recoil at putting Truman in the dock with the greatest monsters of our age. Nevertheless, that Truman should have found himself before a court to answer for his actions seems clear. How such a court's judgment and sentence would read, compared to those of the other four, can be debated. Truman was not a Hitler, Stalin, Mao, or Pol Pot. In this sense, people's intuitions are correct. But that should not stop us from seeing his deeds for what they are. The difficulty of keeping distinct the three tasks of definition, explanation, and moral evaluation muddles considerations of mass murder. The passions of assigning guilt, blame, or moral responsibility hijack the other two usually cooler enterprises. This happens constantly in discussions of the Holocaust, the name for the Germans' annihilation of European Jews. If Truman and Hitler are not to be judged the same, then their acts, so goes the faulty and backward chain of thinking, could not be the same. Similarly, if their deeds cannot be explained in the same way, then they could not be of the same kind. Hitler killed Jews because he was in the grip of an ideology, a fantasy, that held the Jews to be the source of evil in the world. Truman, not beholden to any such fantasy, annihilated the Japanese of Hiroshima and Nagasaki for other, though not entirely clear, reasons. Perhaps his belief that it was just a way to hasten the war's end, even if, as Truman knew, the slaughter was not necessary to end the war soon, or perhaps to demonstrate American power to the Soviets for the emerging Cold War struggle. But these different explanations do not make one slaughter a mass murder and the other not. We can, as a matter of fact, call Truman's annihilation of the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki mass murder, and the man a mass murderer, putting Truman and his deeds into the same broad categories of Hitler and the Holocaust, Stalin and the Gulag, Pol Pot, Mao, Saddam Hussein, and Slobodan Milosevic and their victims, without giving the same explanation for Truman's actions as we do for theirs, and without judging them morally as being equivalent. As Truman's example suggests, we must put an end to a host of fallacies and self-deceptions that have clouded the facts and muddled our judgments. We must consult the corrective lenses of others. We must look at mass killings using impartial criteria. We must keep distinct the tasks of defining, which requires specifying what it is we are examining, of explanation, which requires accounts for why events occur and people act, and of moral evaluation, which requires us to judge the character of events and the culpability of the actors. We must approach the phenomenon with the willingness to think it through systematically and from the beginning. Human beings and mass slaughter. Our investigation of mass murder begins with basic questions. Is it easy or hard to get people to kill others, including children? Some say that, with opportunity, all or most people will readily slaughter others. Others say that human beings will assent to kill others merely because they receive orders to do so. Still others hold that people who find themselves subjected to social psychological pressure to kill will generally do so, or that propaganda can quickly, almost immediately, turn any people into mass executioners of any men, women, and even children. Each of these views has scholarly and common sense or popular versions. Are they right? Are all or most adults potential mass murderers, mass exterminators of children just waiting to be asked to kill? Or must something profound happen to people for them to perpetrate mass slaughter? Are all or most states, are all or most societies proto-genocidal, meaning they could easily be moved to commit genocide? Or are only some ready to be easily incited to slaughter? Why has our age of such technological, economic, and undeniable moral progress seen so much mass slaughter? The foundation for answering these seemingly simple questions is an exploration of critical aspects, in turn, of the nature of human beings, modern societies and their cultures, states, and mass slaughter. Any serious investigation of mass murder must reject two widespread notions. The first consists of several related notions: that people's actions are determined by external forces, that they have little or no say over how they act, that free will is an illusion. Yet if forces or pressures determined people's actions, it would not be so hard to understand mass murder, or so much about our social and political lives in general that we understand only partially or hardly at all. Some people always deviate from what the external forces supposedly acting upon them are said to push them to do. Often, so many do that forces, such as state orders, deemed so powerful in one setting, seem hardly relevant in another, as during rebellions and revolutions. The second faulty notion is the first's curious analog. It holds that internal drives impel people to commit mass murder. When civilization's restraints are lifted, the universally existing antagonism of people unlike oneself, the love of violence, the will to vent aggression, to dominate, to vanquish, and the pleasures of sadism easily awaken the darkened heart, the Caligula that is every man. A kindred view holds that when opportunity presents itself, when the incentives are right, the universal drive for gain will move people, like so many automatons, to kill others. Either way, this notion about innate internal drives is also false. Far from everyone kills or tortures others whenever the opportunity presents itself, or when it appears profitable, or kills or tortures any group of people, regardless of their national, political, ethnic, religious, or linguistic identities. These various notions about human nature are often not articulated, but instead embedded in the discussion of mass murder as unstated assumptions. However explicitly or baldly their proponents state these notions, they rarely investigate, examine, test, or justify them, and fail to assess them against competing views. This is true of scholarly and popular writing and, in my considerable experience, of discussions among acquaintances and friends. The real task is not to postulate that all people have the general capacity to kill and therefore will kill anyone at any time, or, still more wrongheaded, to assume that because of external circumstances or internal drives, those who have killed have done so automatically, and then to declare the investigation closed. The real task is to adopt a more multifaceted and realistic view of humanity and to explain the variation in people's responses to the forces outside them and those, whatever they are, inside them, to understand how people mediate such influences when they move themselves to act. Why do some people kill, though not just anyone, and other people who find themselves in the same situation do not? Why do some people torture and others similarly positioned do not? On a larger scale, why do some groups of people perpetrate mass murder, including slaughtering children, and others who find themselves in very much the same circumstances, say of deprivation or of being at war, do not? To answer these and the many other questions about mass murder, we must begin with several fundamental truths about human beings. People make choices about how to act, even if they do not choose the contexts in which they make them. People make these choices according to their understanding of the social world and their views of what is right and wrong, good and evil, and of their own understanding of how the world is to be shaped and governed, even if different contexts make some choices more or less plausible or easier or more difficult to choose. And people ultimately are the authors of their own actions, because humans are fundamentally beings with a moral dimension, which does not mean we endorse their moral views, and they are so because the human condition is one of agency, namely the capacity and burden of being able to choose to say yes, which means also being able to say no. We must keep these facts about human beings in mind for another reason. Ignoring them depersonalizes and dehumanizes the perpetrators. It turns them into puny abstractions, fleshy automatons with internal robotics programmed by whatever theories are supplying the motor. This also means that when presenting accounts of the perpetrators' deeds, we should not omit them linguistically, as people often do who want it to appear as if some larger forces and not human beings with human motives are effectively doing the killing, or who, for political reasons, wish to obscure the identities of the perpetrators. We should not employ the passive voice which omits the presence of the actors. On this or that day, this or that many Armenians, Chinese, Jews, Tutsi, or Bosnian Muslims were killed, and instead use the active voice. And we should make sure to name the perpetrators and not be afraid to call them Turks when they were Turks, Japanese when they were Japanese, Germans when they were Germans, Soviets when they were Soviets, Americans when they were Americans, Serbs when they were Serbs, Hutu when they were Hutu, political Islamists when they were political Islamists. This linguistic rectitude is not just analytical, but moral as well. Without human beings, without naming them properly, there cannot be moral and legal accountability. Perpetrators who want to escape culpability, foreign leaders who want excuses for inaction or to provide cover for the perpetrators, and scholars and writers who wish to hide the identity of or absolve perpetrators typically use the passive voice. For decades, Germans and many writing about the Holocaust obscured the German perpetrators' identity by using the passive voice or by falsely referring to the perpetrators as Nazis. The vast majority of the German perpetrators were not Nazi party members or any more allegiant to Nazism than Germans in general, and by attacking those calling the perpetrators, as both the German perpetrators and the Jewish victims did at the time, plainly and simply, Germans. A similar consideration to the Germans and their apologists' attempts to absolve the German perpetrators, especially the many ordinary Germans among them, can be seen in the Japanese government's changes to its school textbooks in 2007 that effaced the role of Japanese soldiers during World War II in coercing or inducing 100,000 Okinawans to commit mass suicide before the American invasion of Okinawa. For the previous quarter century, the textbooks rightly specifically named the Japanese's Imperial Army soldiers as the perpetrators. The new textbook version omits the perpetrators completely, asserting that Okinawans simply committed mass suicide or felt the need to do so. This change produced a howl of protest in Okinawa, including local governmental resolutions for a rescission of the textbook falsifications, and a public protest one day in Ginowon of more than 110,000 people, almost 10% of Okinawa's people. During mass murders, the murderers themselves, their supporters, and those who wish to stand idly by practice linguistic camouflage. The Guatemalan murderers used the passive voice in their voluminous and meticulous document keeping. Police do not kidnap a person. Instead, a person is kidnapped. The strange locution, was disappeared, became the standard for many Latin American mass murders. A Guatemalan supervisor wrote on one police agent's report, which used the first person singular, "Never personify. The third person must always be used." Mike Habib, a high U.S. State Department official, in keeping with Secretary of State Warren Christopher's principal objective regarding the Serbs' mass slaughter of Bosniaks, or Bosnian Muslims, which was to prevent the United States from effectively acting to stop the killing, instructed Marshall Harris, the State Department's country officer for Bosnia, to conceal the Serbs' identities and therefore their responsibility for the transgressions. Habib told Harris not to write that the Serbs were shelling a certain town, but rather that there was shelling, or there were reports of shelling. Harris explains that Habib didn't want us to be seen pointing the finger when we weren't going to do anything. Taking seriously people's agency, understanding of the social world, and moral values is essential, and so too is understanding how they come to hold their views. This entails rejecting another common notion, which was for decades common to scholars of Nazism and the Holocaust, and remains the view of those seeking to exculpate Germans and others of their responsibility for their mass murdering and related deeds, that the cultures in which people have grown up and live are irrelevant for understanding their participation in mass murder. This mistaken view contains two interrelated notions, that 1. Every person who has lived in any age or society is equally easily a potential mass murderer of 2. The people of any and all other groups, except possibly his or her own. Yet a person reared in a society with the uncontested common sense, such as in medieval Europe, that Jesus is the Son of God, is overwhelmingly likely to believe that and to feel hostility and be willing to act violently toward people considered evil, Jews, Muslims, heretics, for rejecting Jesus' divinity than toward those sharing his bedrock religious belief. A white growing up in the pre-Civil War American South was overwhelmingly likely to believe that blacks are inherently inferior and to feel more hostility and be willing to use violence toward blacks than he was against whites. A person growing up in a society or in a subculture deeming a certain group of people, whether they are Armenians, Jews, Bosnian Muslims, or Tutsi, to be evil or dangerous, will be more likely to say yes to using violence to rid society of them when it is considered necessary than someone will growing up in a society or subculture deeming the same group to be good or socially munificent. An account of mass slaughter must therefore look to how the circumstances are engendered that first make mass annihilation even thinkable and then an actual option. It must also examine why people eventually embrace or reject such action. This requires a wide range of factors to be systematically assessed, without prejudicing the matter with simplifying, seemingly powerful, yet ultimately untenable assumptions about human nature. This means that we must consider what it is about societies and their cultures that contribute to the circumstances that produce exterminationist conditions, or put differently, that make mass extermination plausible as a group or national project, a project that is led by the state, supported by a good percentage of the nation or its dominant group or groups, and which employs large institutional and material resources. In many societies, groups come to be seen as deleterious to the well-being of the majority, or, sometimes, a powerful minority. How this happens and the character of the pernicious qualities projected onto such groups vary enormously. In some instances, people deem the group's perniciousness so great that they want to eliminate it. In some of the cases, such beliefs become socially powerful and coalesce into an explicit public and political conversation about elimination. At other times, such beliefs hover below the surface, never finding powerful, sustained articulation. In these instances, the eliminationist beliefs do not become the basis of a coherent political ideology, while retaining their potential to do so. Eliminationism. The existence of eliminationist beliefs and desires, conversations and ideologies, and acts and policies has been a central feature of all eras of human history and all sorts of societies. Nevertheless, the many facets of eliminationist beliefs and deeds have not been conceptualized as belonging to a common phenomenon, eliminationism. Even if eliminationism's many forms are better known by their particular and spectacularly horrible consequences and names, such as genocide, the desire to eliminate peoples or groups should be understood to be the overarching category and the core act, and should therefore be the focus of our study. Political and social conflicts among groups exist in all human societies, and often between societies and countries. When unwilling to come to some modus vivendi, groups, people, and polities, usually the dominant groups within them, deal with populations they have conflict with or see as a danger that must be neutralized by seeking to eliminate them or to destroy their capacity to inflict putative harm. To do this, they employ any of the 5 principal forms of elimination: transformation, repression, expulsion, prevention of reproduction, or extermination. Transformation is the destruction of a group's essential and defining political, social, or cultural identities in order to neuter its members' alleged noxious qualities. Eliminationist transformation, which is often accompanied by violence or its threat, differs from the ordinary processes of education or acculturation because it is directed at suppressing others rather than giving them new skills or expanding their possibilities. Groups' real or alleged features or practices, religious, ethnic, or cultural, among others, that putatively set them off from the dominant culture or group, have been transformative projects' main target. Historically, conquerors and empires have commonly sought to assimilate conquered peoples and areas by destroying their distinctive identities and loyalties. It has also been frequently done in our age. The Turks have at various times suppressed spoken and written Kurdish. In the first half of the 20th century, the Japanese, having colonized Korea, tried to destroy an independent Korean identity, including by forbidding the use of Korean. The Germans during the Nazi period, the Soviets, the Communist Chinese, and many others have also sought to forcibly transform victim peoples. Many eliminationist projects animated by religion have compelled people of other religions to convert, sometimes on the pain of death. Historically, Christianity and Islam had this project at their core. Christianity focused its most fervent eliminationist project of 2,000 years, the one against the Jews, on transformation through conversion, often threatening or using violence against those who would resist. Our time has seen many such forced conversions. Today, powerful strains of political Islam maintain this transformative orientation as a high priority. Repression entails keeping the hated, deprecated, or feared people within territorial reach and reducing, with violent domination, their ability to inflict real or imagined harm upon others. Such repression has been a regular feature of human societies. Its most extreme form is enslavement, which does have sources besides the desire to reduce a threat. Though few do today, most human societies have had slavery. Other violent forms are at least as common. Apartheid, a legal system of domination, political disenfranchisement, economic exploitation, and physical separation of a subordinate group, existed until recently in South Africa, and, under the name of segregation, not so much longer ago in the American South. Political and legal segregation and ghettoization are, by definition, forms of eliminationist repression. Repression, including the ongoing threat of violence and its occasional or frequent use, exists against many groups: peasants, workers, ethnic groups, religious groups, political groups, and more, in many countries today. Expulsion, often called deportation, is a third eliminationist option. It removes unwanted people more thoroughly by driving them beyond a country's borders or from one region of a country to another, or compelling them en masse into camps. From antiquity to today, expulsions, often by imperial conquerors, have been common. In the ancient world, victors routinely killed many among their vanquished enemies and expelled others, often into slavery. The Assyrians routinely deported conquered peoples. The Romans expelled and enslaved enemies who had rebelled or who excessively resisted them, including the Carthaginians at the end of the Third Punic War. Spaniards expelled their Muslim minority in 1502, and then again from 1609 to 1614. The English deported 100,000 Irish to North America and the West Indies from 1641 to 1652. The English, French, and others banished Romas, called Gypsies, in the 16th century. Americans drove Native Americans from their lands, perhaps most infamously the 1838 Cherokee Trail of Tears, an 800-mile winter trek that killed perhaps 4,000 Cherokee, and forced them onto remote reservations during the 19th century. During World War II, the Soviets undertook internal expulsions, forcing 8 different ethnic groups, including the Crimean Tatars, from their homes in the Soviet Union's western part, scattering them hundreds or thousands of miles into the interior. Germans during World War II expelled Poles and others from various regions, and then after the war, Czechs, Hungarians, and Poles took their turn driving out ethnic Germans. During the period of Israel's establishment in 1948, the Jews partly created the Palestinian diaspora by expelling Palestinians from their homeland. This coincided with many Arab countries expelling Jews beginning in 1948. In 1972, Ugandans expelled their ethnic Indians. In 1974 through 1975, Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots expelled each other from their respective parts of Cyprus. From 1988 to 1991, Saddam depopulated entire areas of Iraq of Kurds, destroying their villages and their agricultural base and depositing many into camps. And then, in 1991 to 1992, expelled the Shia Marsh people from their region of southern Iraq, in each instance as part of a broader exterminatory and eliminationist campaign. During Yugoslavia's breakup, ethnic expulsion was a constituent part of the conflicts, including the Serbs' massive expulsion of Kosovo's ethnic Albanians, also known as Kosovars, in 1999. Today, we witness the ongoing mass murder and expulsions of Darfurians by Sudan's political Islamic government. The unfortunate term ethnic cleansing, the perpetrator's euphemism for deeds opposite of the beneficent act of cleansing, became, during Yugoslavia's breakup, a standard of the international lexicon to characterize expulsions, particularly when accompanied by mass slaughters or smaller terror killings. Author's note: actual resettlement, as opposed to expulsions, euphemistically called resettlement, differs from expulsion in two respects. The people being resettled are seen by their government, the broader society, and themselves as members of a larger national community. And second, the government attempts to create new and some semblance of decent lives for them, even if the attempt falls short. Resettlement may occur because of economic projects, such as building dams, or because of geostrategic necessities, such as resettling Israelis from settlements in Gaza to Israel proper. The most frequent victims of expulsions have been Jews. During ancient times, Babylonians drove them from ancient Israel, and during medieval times, the peoples of one city, region, and country of Europe after another expelled them. Every part of Europe expelled Jews at some time. England expelled its Jews in 1290, France in 1306. Most German regions expelled their Jews during the 14th century. Many Arab countries did the same, starting in 1948. As late as 1968, Europe saw another expulsion of Jews, this time from communist Poland, which forced out approximately 20,000 in a supposed anti-Zionist campaign. The best known such expulsion remains the Inquisition-inspired one from Spain in 1492. The Spaniards and the transnational Catholic Church's eliminationist campaign against the Jews is particularly noteworthy because its perpetrators employed four of the eliminationist means: transformation, forced conversion, repression, expulsion, and selective killing. Prevention of reproduction is a fourth eliminationist act. It is the least frequently used, and when employed, it is usually in conjunction with others. For varying reasons, those wishing to eliminate a group in whole or in part can seek to diminish its numbers by interrupting normal biological reproduction. They prevent its members from becoming pregnant or giving birth. They sterilize them. They systematically rape women so men will not want to marry or father children with them, or to themselves impregnate them so they bear children not purely of their group, thereby weakening the group biologically and socially. Preventing reproduction is an eliminationist act with the longer time horizon of future generations, while the perpetrators simultaneously employ different eliminationist means for those currently living, or sometimes none at all. The Nazis forcibly sterilized many Germans suffering from real or imagined congenital afflictions without otherwise eliminating them, and considered sterilizing Jews as an alternative to killing them. The Serbs systematically raped Bosniaks and Kosovars while murdering many others and expelling many more. Extermination is the fifth eliminationist act. Radical as it is, killing often logically follows beliefs deeming others to be a great, even mortal threat. It promises not an interim, not a piecemeal, not only a probable, but a final solution to the putative problem. The most notorious final solution, giving this infamous euphemism worldwide currency, was the Germans' mass murder of the Jews. Hitler and those following him first employed a variety of lesser eliminationist measures against the Jews until circumstances arose that permitted them to finally implement a program for their total extermination. Already in 1920, Hitler, in the speech, "Why Are We Anti-Semites?", publicly declared the general eliminationist intent, the removal of the Jews from our Volk, and specified his preferred exterminationist solution, which he hoped the German people would, one day, implement. Hitler explained, "We are animated with an inexorable resolve to seize the evil, the Jews, by the roots, and to exterminate it root and branch. To attain our aim, we should stop at nothing." This is an utterly clear and carefully formulated statement of an eliminationist, in this case exterminationist, ideal. According to Hitler, 1. The Jews are so evil and dangerous that, 2. They must be exterminated root and branch, that is, totally, and 3. The need to do so is so acute that Germans should let nothing stay their hand. To make it unmistakable that this was no frivolous statement either about the extent of the putative danger or the utter emergency of eliminating it, Hitler continued his declaration, "We should stop at nothing," by concluding, "even if we must join forces with the devil." The devil is less to be feared than the Jews. Extermination has also been a staple of all eras and parts of the world, though historical accounts are often so sketchy, we cannot be sure that certain slaughters occurred or of the number of victims. In ancient times, peoples often slew those they conquered. In some places, such as ancient Greece, so commonly that the discussion of the mass annihilation was an unremarkable topic. In the celebratory Iliad, Homer has Agamemnon, the commander of the Greek forces arrayed against Troy, speaking to his brother Menelaus about the Trojans, and through him to his assembled troops and all Greeks for all time. "They've ground the truce under their heels. They'll pay for their misdeeds in lives, in wives and children. For this I know well in my heart and soul, the day must come when holy Ilion, Troy, is given to fire and sword, and Priam, the Trojan king, perishes, good lance though he was, with all his people." In the Jewish Bible, God instructs the ancient Jews to slaughter the peoples living in the promised land of ancient Israel. In the medieval world, mass murders were common, which the perpetrators often consecrated by invoking God. In the name of their Lord, Christian crusaders slaughtered Jews, Muslims, and others in the 11th and 12th centuries. This age's greatest butchers were probably Genghis Khan and the Mongols, who killed peoples over vast terrain in Asia and Eastern Europe in the 13th century. In early modern and modern times, imperial European peoples slaughtered many less technologically advanced peoples of other continents. In our time, virtually all manner of peoples have perpetrated mass murder against virtually all kinds of victims. Identifying these five eliminationist means of transformation, repression, expulsion, prevention of reproduction, and annihilation suggests something fundamental that has escaped notice. From the perpetrator's viewpoint, these eliminationist means are rough functional equivalents. They are different technical solutions to the perceived problem of dealing with unwanted or putatively threatening groups, to fulfilling the most fundamental desire of somehow getting rid of such groups, which Germans emblematically expressed in one of the most frequent rallying cries before and during the Nazi period, Juden raus, Jews out. As radically different as the various measures are for the victims, for the perpetrators, the solutions logically follow their eliminationist beliefs, are substitutes for one another, and can be employed interchangeably. Conceptualizing these forms of violence as variations of the same phenomenon of eliminationism itself suggests that when perpetrators embark on an eliminationist program, they might use several of them simultaneously. Just as the Spaniards, during the Inquisition in the late 15th century, used four of the eliminationist means at once against the Jews. Elisa Murat-Kaus, president of the Association of Concentration Camp Torture Survivors in Sarajevo, explains that the Serbs aimed to eliminate all Bosnian people. Yet they used a variety of means. Some people will be expelled to another country, a Western country. Some people would be killed. Some people will be kept alive for maybe the Serbs' personal needs. Who knows, maybe like slavery. Indeed, when people adopt one eliminationist measure, they frequently also employ other ones in a subsidiary or complementary manner. The Turkish leaders codified the use of a plurality of such instruments in a preparatory document for the eliminationist assault on the Armenians. They called for extermination, all males under 50 among others, expulsion, carry away the families of all those who succeed in escaping, and transformation, girls and children to be Islamized. When perpetrators use mass expulsion as the principal eliminationist policy, they typically complement it with selective killing, sometimes on a large scale. The peoples of different European countries, regions, and cities not only expelled Jews from their midst during medieval times, they also episodically slaughtered them, ghettoized them, and compelled them to convert as part of a centuries-long church-inspired orientation to eliminate Jews from their midst. And if, as with the Soviets, the expulsions do not deposit the victims outside the country, then repression, usually severe, follows to ensure the victims do not return home or rebel. This unrecognized yet startlingly intimate relationship among the various eliminationist means of transformation, repression, expulsion, prevention of reproduction, and annihilation is crucial to acknowledge and explore. Several questions present themselves. Regarding mass slaughter, is it so distinct from other eliminationist forms that it is a single phenomenon unrelated to the others? Or is it on an eliminationist continuum of increasing violence related to the other forms but qualitatively different? Or is it a rough, functional equivalent of the others, meaning the different eliminationist options emanate from the same source, so the perpetrators see them as effectively achieving the same ends, and their choice of which to use depends on tactics, practicality, expediency, and perhaps the perpetrator's moral restraints? Regarding eliminationist policy's genesis, where do eliminationist beliefs come from? Is there something distinctive about the ones of our age? How do eliminationist beliefs, or even an eliminationist ideology, get translated into eliminationist action? Put differently, what has to happen for beliefs to move people to act? Regarding eliminationist policy's character, whatever those mechanisms may be, why do eliminationist beliefs sometimes lie dormant and sometimes get translated into action? When such beliefs produce action, why do they sometimes lead to one eliminationist policy, transformation, sometimes a second, repression, sometimes a third, expulsion, sometimes a fourth, prevention of reproduction, and sometimes a fifth, mass slaughter, and at other times, some combination of them? And if it is relatively easy for the politics of one eliminationist kind to slide and morph along the continuum into another, should we treat a regime's violent repression of peoples or groups as inherently prone to exterminationism or proto-exterminationism? Eliminationist beliefs have been commonly held by ordinary people throughout history. Yet such beliefs have not always led to action, because alone they do not generate mass slaughter or elimination. Extermination and elimination programs are not inevitable. Eliminationist beliefs, though all but a necessary cause, are not in themselves a sufficient cause of mass murder or elimination. This was true, as I have shown elsewhere, even for the Holocaust. Eliminationist anti-Semitism among Germans was enormously widespread, deeply rooted, and potent in its demonology, but lay dormant until Hitler and the state he led initiated, organized, and oversaw the Jews' mass murder. To understand why exterminationist and eliminationist assaults occur in some places and times and not in others where eliminationist beliefs are also widespread, it is critical, not just for the Holocaust but in all other instances, to always look to the political arena, to political leaders, to, in our time by and large, the state.